Hello and good morning, everybody. Welcome to the Digitally Uploaded podcast. We have an awful lot of stuff to talk about this week. With me this week, we have Alan, who's back.
I'm actually not dead, contrary to popular belief. I do exist in this world.
Sometimes we let you out anyway.
I like it. Sometimes. I like it when it's not dark.
Have you on, and we also have James.
Howdy.
How you doing, James?
I'm all right. I've had a lot of coffee. Perhaps too much, but that's all right. We'll get through this.
Yes, that's all right. It's going to be a long podcast because we're going to be talking about dun 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 Ghost Recon Wildlands. Yes. Very exciting.
Can you feel the excitement in this podcast right now?
We'll get everybody in a good mood with some Hatsune Miku music, and then we'll just ruin it with talking about it. Welcome back, and Wildlands.
what an introduction, and Wildlands. Amazing.
The best game of all time, I'm sure.
Straight after Nier Automata or before?
Yeah, it's definitely, I mean, Nier's got nothing. I uninstalled Nier immediately as soon as I started playing this. This will be the only game I ever need on my PlayStation 4 ever.
That and Skylight Free Range, of course.
Oh, yeah, and Skylight Free Range. Although Skylight Free Range might be just a little bit better than Wildlands. It's hard, you know, indie spirit and all that.
I get the impression you don't like this very much.
Yeah, let's be a little bit serious for a second. I really hate Ghost Recon Wildlands. Where do I start with it? So as background for anybody who might not have heard about the game and probably doesn't follow me on Twitter, therefore, because I've been ranting about it for a solid week.
It has been a fairly long time now as well. Like, this has been building up over the course of like a week and a half at this point.
Yeah. So Ghost Recon Wildlands is Ubisoft's latest open worlder. It kind of came out of, well, I think it's fair to say it kind of came out of nowhere. I mean, everyone got a little bit excited for Honor because it was a new IP and all that. And then Ghost Recon had its beta and then landed.
I think it kind of got caught up in the Q1 madness that we've seen this year. It kind of just got swept up in that.
Yeah. I think that's pretty fair to say. I don't think the hype behind this one was quite as much as Ubisoft might have wanted. And as a result, I mean, for Ubisoft's sake, it's probably a good thing because this game is really terrible. On a gameplay level, I mean, I know, James, you've been playing it as well. We'll hear what you have to say about it in a moment. But on a gameplay level, I think it's okay-ish. I mean, if you're into Ubisoft's approach to open world games, then it is a Ubisoft open world game. So it kind of works on that level.
It looks like a combination of about 5 years of Ubisoft game. Like TM.
Yeah, it is. And I mean, it seems to me to be playing on some older games. I mean, I know James and I were talking about Mercenaries and how it kind of seems to want to be like Mercenaries, which was an absolutely brilliant PlayStation 2 game back in the day. And it was a lot of fun. And it seems like it wants to be that kind of thing in that you're in this big open world and you've got basically a drug cartel to take down. And you need to start by taking out the lieutenants, which lets you work up to the underbosses. And then eventually you get to take on the big dude himself. And then it's game over. Credits roll.
Elsewhere.
Yeah, that's the fellow. He's got lots of tattoos because...
You know, I was going to say, the only thing I know about this game is that his tattoos look ridiculous.
He's got a giant cross tattooed on his face.
As you do.
Yeah, as you do. Yeah. When your name's El Sueño.
El Sueño. That's a pretty cool name.
Yeah, he's basically a walking cliche. Let's put it that way.
What? A walking cliche in a Ubisoft game? Ow.
Well, yeah. That's kind of the gameplay stuff works. There's issues with it, like the driving's all out, and the less you try and fly the planes around, the better.
It works in the sense that we've seen it all before. You know, it's kind of tried and true, I suppose, in that sense.
Yeah, that's it. You kind of know what you're getting going into it, and you get what you know you're getting going into it. So, yeah, from that level, then whatever. But for me, the big issue with the game, and it's probably the best example of this that I've been kind of ranting on about for years now, is the way that it portrays, a fairly American exceptionalism, or Western exceptionalism, nationalism, pro-military worship, and all this kind of stuff that has been an issue with the way that games kind of look at the difference between the West and the rest of the world. And this game really does epitomize a lot of my criticisms about that. To the point, I mean, Bolivia itself actually lodged an official complaint with France, because Ubisoft being a French company, about the way that the game presents Bolivia. And I think they're quite within their rights to do so.
If the main game suddenly starring like, this is Australia, this is realistic Australia, and there was like just like Bogans like shooting people everywhere, like sweet, yeah, cool. I'd be like, yeah, fucking cool, Ubisoft.
Probably. Postal.
Well, it's not just that. I mean, it's also the idea that
it's just Redfern.
It's also the idea that American soldiers can kind of go into a place like Bolivia and shoot the place up.
But they're ghosts. Nobody knows they're there.
Yeah, it's
that. The Ghost Recon.
Fuck, man. This game is so utterly fucking tone deaf. Like, to the wider world that we live in at the moment, it is so completely tone deaf. Like, it is actually staggering. I think within the first 5 minutes, even after just watching that opening that opening video where El Sueño was walking through some fucking church talking about, sorry, I know I shouldn't swear on this podcast, but I get upset. he's wandering through like some church and just like talking about how he wants to turn Bolivia into a cartel state and how he's managed to overtake the Bolivian government. Like somehow the Bolivian government has just folded over under the weight of his cartel. And now he's like basically in charge of the entire country. And all of a sudden, like these four American soldiers are just going to come in and save the day. Like, are you kidding me, man? I mean, in the shadow of what's going on in the Middle East, like that is just absolutely the most unbelievably tone deaf presentation of it. Like, oh man, it's just utterly staggering, completely staggering.
Yeah, it really
Sorry,
is.
Sorry, I just had to unleash that. That's been well
on top of that. The reason that they're actually in there in the first place is ridiculous. It's like they're there because some CIA operative had like her buddy.
It was like embedded. It was embedded for 6 years or something, and then was discovered and shot. It's like as another critic, Alex Navarro from Giant Bomb, pointed out, it's basically the plot from Clear and Present Danger without like Jack Ryan. You know, like. Oh my goodness!
Yeah, so the four American ghosts go in there and they literally blow the Bolivia to shreds. Like there's very little consequence to going around and shooting everything that you come across.
It looks like Tom Clancy's like Just Cause.
Yeah, kind of. Without the cool explosions
and without like the self-awareness.
Self-awareness. Yeah, it's ridiculous. It's terrible. And you know, it's. Even the little things, like for anybody who's listening to the podcast who isn't quite aware of all the stuff that went on in Bolivia, but stuff happened and you know, they had Che Guevara issues. Well, he came in and he tried to get you know, a revolution going, and that's actually where he ended up getting caught and killed and all that kind of stuff. So you know, there is all of that kind of political history in Bolivia, which the game basically narrows down to like a picture of Che on a target. And that's the only reference I've seen to him in the whole game, which firstly doesn't really reflect, you know, the politics of the region. And secondly, makes it quite clear where Ubisoft sits on the whole topic. And yeah, it's just those little things like the supposed eye for detail in this kind of open world is just constantly skewed towards this very pro-interventionist kind of pro-Western powers doing whatever the fuck they like in places like Bolivia. And it's just terrible. It really is. And you know, you can talk as much as you like about games should be about the gameplay and all that kind of nonsense, but
the fucking gameplay is not even that. God, all right. I will stop swearing from this point. I promise.
But just the gameplay, the entire gameplay last 10 minutes of discussion. It's okay.
The gameplay is not even that great. Like it is great under a very specific. No, not even great. It is passable under a very specific set of circumstances. You need to have people that you know, like friends, to play with, and you need to be able to completely disconnect yourself from any of the political ongoings or like any of the story stuff that's happening in the game and purely just focus on the kind of okay shooting mechanics and the kind of okay planning out the approach to taking out a compound, like that kind of thing can work. But I mean, I think outside of that, it is completely banal and heavy-handed and man, disappointing, I suppose.
So from what I've gathered, because I was like moderately interested in this game because like I really like Rainbow Six Siege. Like that game is like a top tier game. And I was like, maybe they can do that sort of quality again. Maybe it can be a fun. It's not. It looks dumb. It's dumb.
It totally. Like, I think the potential for hijinks is probably there. Like, but like I said,
you can do that in any game.
Yeah, but like, I mean, in this, like, at least it has that four player co-op thing going for it. Like, just to, you know, I don't want to completely trash it because it does like get a small margin of it right, but man, it is unbelievably tone deaf. And like, I think in this day and age when, you know, people are a bit more woke than they used to be when it comes to this kind of thing, you just can't be like, Ubisoft has done this several times in the past.
It made a more racist Far Cry 3.
Where, yeah, like, what are they doing? Hey, like, I suppose Paris is about aren't they about to elect a conservative government? So I don't know what the fuck's going on in France, but I hope
it's not the first time that Ubisoft has done something like this with an open worlder, like The Division.
Oh yeah, well, classic. Like, easily. Oh, let's get civilians to shoot other civilians that then loot buildings.
Yeah. Well, yeah, it's pretty easy. I mean, it's a pretty obvious defense of authoritarianism and stuff like that as well. So it's not like this doesn't come out of the blue for Ubisoft, but it's just weird because that company has also created like real games that
they made Valiant Hearts.
I know, I was just about to say that. You know, they've done games that are really, really with really strong messages and very, you know, potent and very important kind of games like that. And then they kind of run around and do this. And it's just disappointing. You know, I don't have a problem with Ubisoft's open world games. Like, I really like the Assassin's Creed games, for instance. And, you know, I didn't mind, you know, some of the stuff about Watch Dogs either. I didn't begrudge it. And I don't begrudge what Ghost Recon tries to do in terms of the way it plays and its structure. What I really don't like is just the way it's presented, because like James has said a number of times, with swears thrown in, it's just tone deaf and just unnecessary.
We should make this episode like at least MA15 at this point.
Yeah. And you know, if you can't do a game like this without doing that kind of story, then just don't do the bloody game in the first place.
Yeah, you got to come into something like this with a bit of nuance, you know. It's not something that, like, to me, what you just said about, you know, Ubisoft sort of coming out from the top down, it feels like they're just throwing a bunch of things at the wall and just finding what will stick, you know, with regards to their open world games, because they're all kind of all over the place.
Welcome back. We finally got James to stop ranting about Wildlands.
And another thing. Sorry, I'll stop.
Buy that gag title.
It's not worth it. There's only so much editing I can do.
we probably should talk about something a bit different, otherwise we'll just keep getting angry. So on a completely different note to a game that actually is not completely tone deaf, Overwatch. James, you were telling us that you're just getting into Overwatch now, and I think it's interesting for, you know, with more and more games being quite, you know, serious online and competitive, how new players kind of get along with these games once they kind of step into them for the first time. Because to me, basically, whenever I've started to play a shooter or something late and I've wandered into online, I've kind of backed out again pretty quickly, because it's pretty intimidating when you get stuck up against really quality players. So, I mean, is that your experience with Overwatch?
So far, yes. It's funny that this is actually the topic, because I'm kind of working on a piece that has to do with this exact topic for IGN at the moment. And basically, the reason I wanted to play Overwatch was because I'd heard that they make use of like some single player bots just to as like a sort of a training mechanism. But then it's not really, I mean, it doesn't really, like, it has bots of two of the main heroes, and if anything, it's more of a, you know, a free run where you just, you kind of get free run of the map itself. I think it's like a pre-game skirmish kind of setting, I think, that they put you in, just to try out characters and heroes and that kind of thing.
Yeah.
But, yeah, so far, Overwatch, it's good, but it's definitely got a lot to it. I was kind of expecting, just based on, you know, standard sort of internet chatter that I hear, that Overwatch was kind of the simple shooter. And it's actually got quite a bit more depth to it than I was expecting, just purely because of the meta of the game. All the heroes are different. They all have their own strengths and weaknesses. They all... like it's a class based, like they're character class based heroes. So is that, I mean, you have a bit more of experience with the game than I do. Is that right, Alan?
Yes. Yeah. So I think one of the most,
you take over, like, because I am making
the here we go as the shooter guy. So basically at this point, I feel like the Overwatch community is pretty good in terms of getting new players in. I came back after about a 3.5 month break of not playing the game, got back into it pretty easily. It's quite good at sort of, I guess, really gently pushing you back in, like with different characters, because it explains everything immediately. I think that's the most important thing. Whereas in a game like Team Fortress back in the day, there was no way for you to know that, like, oh yeah, you can do this with this character or whatever, because like it's never explained. But they do that immediately with like a skill explanation like page that you can always hit. I think it's F like 5. Mm-hmm. It very, very clearly defines what your character can do, what they are, and like, you know, how they play. And I think really another important thing as well is that it does silhouetting very well, because, you know, you obviously need to identify who you're playing against. And it's a case of more, I guess, showing through character design and silhouetting what sort of enemies you'll be facing. Because if you look at a Tracer, you're not going to think she's a tank, like, at all.
No.
She's not going to be a tank at all. But if you look like a Roadhog or a Reinhardt, who's this big dude with a shield, like, he's going to be a tank. It's the most Blizzard character ever, so, like, he's going to be a tank.
Sure.
Yeah.
But I suppose even then, like, so you using that kind of language, like, tank, for someone like me who's kind of new to these kinds of games, like, that comes with a bit of a, like, a precursor to connotation to it, you know?
Yeah.
Like, is the tank kind of character someone that would, do they, like, lead the charge? They're, like, generally, crazy offensive? Yes. Right, okay.
They're not crazy offensive. They control the push of the offensive. Generally, you'll have, like, a couple of people playing a, like, an offensive role, like a soldier or a tracer or a pharaoh, that sort of thing. And then they'll sort of be trying to stay alive and trying to get picks on other people on the other team, whereas the tank's role is to keep everyone safe and to keep the damage off the DPS heroes.
Right.
So DPS, think, damage per second.
I think that's the that's probably, I mean, what you're talking about there, James, is probably the thing that I think keeps a lot of players off a lot of these games. Once you know the game's been out for a while, they develop a language.
Definitely.
And start trying to get into it once that language is already established, especially when you've got players that are maybe less tolerant towards new players. So they don't like to hear questions like, what does this mean? What does that mean? All of that kind of stuff. It can feel intimidating, if not hostile. To give a couple of examples from my own perspective, I mean, I once had the insane idea that I'd give League of Legends a go.
No, back away, Matt.
And, you know, as a guy who even plays a lot of RPGs, who plays a lot of MMOs, who is, you know, across, you know, words like DPS and tanks, and I know what those kinds of roles are, I still found the game just completely incomprehensible. And that's not, I mean, obviously the people playing it understand it well, but that's because they've had, you know, months of play to kind of build up an understanding of it. And the same kind of goes for MMOs. You know, I step back in and out of Final Fantasy 14 quite a bit, depending on what time I've got. And every time I step in, there's a whole bunch of stuff that I need to learn new that's been added since I last played. And the player conversations have changed around. I need to try and figure out, you know, what dungeons I need to do, how I find the people to actually try some of those dungeons when they're less popular now. And it's just, it's a learning process. And even though I've played, I think it's about 2 weeks worth of total time in Final Fantasy 14, it's again a couple of hour process. Sorry?
Just a casual weekend.
Well, it's been out for a long time now, to be fair. So, but every time I step back into it, I do need to go through a couple of hours of relearning or learning new parts. And for a new player, somebody to step in completely new to Final Fantasy 14 now, it would be pretty intimidating. And I think game developers as a whole have a very poor understanding on how to make a game welcoming to newcomers. I don't know if it's even possible. Maybe they need to create some kind of alternate version of it for new players that's just for new players or something. I don't know.
It's kind of like the ultimate rock and a hard place problem for developers of MOBAs and basically games that require an online a constant online presence, is that, you know, you want players on all the time. You want to build that constant community and you want players to stick with your game, which means they are naturally going to gain experience, and naturally that community is going to get more experienced. And there is going to be that tipping point where you have a separation between new players and the experienced players. And it's kind of a really interesting problem for developers to try and solve. And I don't think it's one that they've come close to solving yet, outside of, you know, trying to keep on top of it in a way that's more reactive rather than kind of proactive. Does that make sense? Not to suggest that developers aren't trying to fix this problem, but it seems to me that they're only that so far the most effective solution has been to just sort of chase this thing around.
Well, for me, one of the things I think could help, especially now that we've got that whole esports thing emerge, I don't watch a whole lot of esports, but whenever I dabble in it, one of the first things that hits me is that, you know, the commentators talk with, you know, in the language of the experienced players. The whole event is run, you know, in the language, and I'm talking about, you know, the visuals and as well as the actual spoken word, but everything about those events is always in the language for people who are experienced. So I think there's that really big block for people who might be interested in, say, Overwatch or League of Legends or whatever, but you know, if they go and try and watch some esports of it, it's just going to confuse the living hell out of them. And that then becomes a barrier to entry where, you know, they would almost be better off actually picking up the thing and playing it themselves. So I think the whole esports community and the whole way that these games are presented to the broad audience needs to have a rethink. I think if you watch, if you watch a cricket or football match or whatever, you know, those sports are the rules are weird if you don't actually know what's going on. But over, you know, a very long time now, people have worked out how to be able to talk about these sports in a way that, you know, if it's your first cricket match ever, you can sit down, watch the commentary, and over, you know, a couple of hours kind of really get a hang of it, and you won't ever feel like they're talking in a different language to what you're listening to. So I think there's a lot of learning that we can do in the games industry around more, you know, established sports and how they're presented to newcomers to get people into it. Anyway, that's me. Alan. Yeah.
So basically, problem for us. Basically what you're asking for is a NAB Oz kick, but for the games, and I would absolutely love that. I would absolutely enjoy that. Because that would solve all the issues. Just get every kid to play like Trackmania or something for a while, get them around it.
PlayStation 4 had a kind of big sort of update this week. A new, I don't know, they're not patches, they're what, console software
updates.
What are they called? Updates? Okay. Yeah. Anyway, it had an update which allowed people to, amongst other things, finally use external hard drives with their PlayStation 4 for installing and loading games and stuff, which is pretty cool. I've now got an 8 terabyte hard drive sitting there, and I am currently killing my ISP by downloading everything back onto it. unlimited plans for the win. I'm really killing my ISP. They're going to hate me. They're going to cut me off for this. Anyway, beyond the fact that it's really cool that you can now install like 1,000 games onto your PS4 and have them all sitting there, and beyond the fact that Sony conveniently timed that right after the Nintendo Switch and ended up being, you know, almost a bigger announcement.
What?
Yeah.
Don't make me read through the screen, man.
No, but one of the things I have noticed is going back and kind of starting to re-download and reinstall games onto my new shiny external drive. There's an awful lot of games on the PS4 that we've kind of forgotten about, given the console's only been out, 4 years now? And, you know, we talk about all the new stuff, especially this year, given there is so much new stuff. But, you know, if you go back to the first couple of years of the console, there's a lot of really cool stuff that you might have played and forgotten. It's a good excuse. What I'm saying is it's a good excuse to go back to, you know, the older stuff. Give it a go again. For instance, you know, we talk a lot about Final Fantasy 15 in, you know, the Final Fantasy fan circles. But you know, PlayStation 4 had Final Fantasy Type Zero release on it, second year, I think, of it. And it's really good. In many ways, it's better than Final Fantasy 15, and nobody remembers that game existing. unfortunately. And, you know, there's other games like Dragon Age Inquisition. Who remembers that one? Not so many people. Well, people might remember it, but people wouldn't have played it for a long time. And it's certainly off a lot of hard drives, I would imagine. There's just this endless stream of content that the PlayStation 4 has had. And that gets me to my next controversial point. I reckon it's probably going to be the best console ever by the time it's finished.
You probably only halfway video through. Games, you just called video games content, so that's one strike. And now you're coming out content, and
read the marketing.
All of these sweeping statements. I knew you were a madman. I didn't know you were this mad.
Yeah, you certainly are.
James is like sitting in the corner just like screaming like man yells at cloud.
He's just in denial. He completely agrees with me 100%.
Oh man. Look, I'll tell you what. I will agree with you that the PlayStation 4 is an excellent console because I came back into the PlayStation fold relatively late. So I missed I actually entirely missed the PlayStation 2 and 3 era, and I only got PS4 when you heard me correctly. And I only got a PS4 when No Man's Sky came out. Since No Man's Sky, I have played almost exclusively my PS4. I haven't gone back to the Xbox at all. Which,
that's about right.
I mean, it's hardly surprising, isn't it? I mean,
there's scale bound. Now there's no games.
There is no scale bound on on a technical level, like the PS4 is like the superior console. There is no, like when we're talking in terms of consoles, because I also have a pretty kick-ass PC sitting here. But in terms of the consoles, it's by far the most powerful. So obviously I'm going to play games on that. If I played multiplayer games, I'd probably play more of the Xbox, but because I have more friends on the Xbox, but I don't really play multiplayer games all that much. So... And like one of the things that excited me about going back to PlayStation is purely that backlog, because I know there are so many fantastic games on the system that I do eventually want to go back and play just have never had the chance to.
Like the thing with the PlayStation 3 was I came to that particular console quite late.
It doesn't surprise me. It sold for $1,000 on release.
Oh, yeah. Remember that announcement?
But man,
it's 5-year-old Alan was just screaming.
It did take a long time for the PlayStation 3 to start getting content. Haha, James, content.
So reductive.
But it took a long
go
time
for the PlayStation 3. Go speak on Wildland content.
Yeah, that is a non-content game.
No, but yeah, the PlayStation 3 took a long time to really start taking off. And then I think everybody would agree that the second half of that console was when it really proved itself. The thing was, I got a PlayStation 4 at launch, and aside from, you know, the first couple of months when, you know, it took a while for developers to start creating stuff for it and they were still busily releasing their last PlayStation 3 games, once that transition happened properly, the console just... Yeah, you know, hasn't gone away since, and it just keeps accelerating further and further. Well past the Xbox in terms of games, I won't say content again. Well past the Xbox in terms of the quality and quantity of the games that are on it. Sony backs third parties and gets all those kinds of, you know, exclusives like Neo and stuff on there. No Man's Sky was, you know, console exclusive, whether you like it or not. It's a big game. Shut up, Alan.
Honestly, Microsoft's biggest issue at the moment is not being in Japan, I think, because there is some absolute gold coming out of that country at the moment. Man, it's a really big thing because, sorry not to cut you off, Alan, but because Microsoft purely just has the Western-based studios, it's very much it feels like a single flavor of game that sort of comes out. I mean, talk indies aside, because I think indie games are just a weird and wonderful thing in and of themselves, but talking like AAA titles, it's very much a single kind of experience with a lot of the Microsoft games, if you know what I mean.
Yeah.
Yeah, lots of shooting, lots of gore.
There's Gears kind of War or Forza Horizon. Or
it's all stuff that we've done before. Like, it's, I mean, a lot of it is just sequels. We're not seeing too many new IPs coming out. Like, I mean, the only real one that I'm excited about is Sea of Thieves.
Yes, that looks really cool.
That looks fantastic.
And I also, but yeah, I think
it's really important to note as well that you've got a developer like the entirety of the SCEE/SCEJ, whatever it's called, and they're all doing their own things, and because they're also like around the world, they all have different interpretations of things, so you end up with like these very like varied experiences. Where on Xbox, it's kind of just like, hey, you like cars? We got cars.
Exactly.
Cool.
And I think
plus,
that kind
they
of
have Bloodborne on the PS4, and it's like the world's greatest game of all time, so it's fine.
Yeah, I mean, I think like for Microsoft, that worked last generation with the Xbox 360 and the PS3, because I think the Japanese game industry went through a bit of self-searching that generation.
I think so as well.
And yeah, it took a while. Like there was a definite dip in terms of the commercial viability of Japanese games, the quality and the quantity of what they were putting out. And it took a while for Japan to kind of, the Japanese industry to rediscover itself and find its new relevance in the market. And while that was happening, there was Sony kind of, you know, doing the same thing as Microsoft, basically. And Microsoft obviously had that depth with the Western studios. And you know, Microsoft was an early leader through the 360 era with the indies. It was probably definitely the first console manufacturer to really get the value that indies added to a console. And for a while there, yeah, everything was indies. Indies were going to Microsoft first and foremost. That changed. You know, Sony is definitely light years ahead of every other publisher out there in terms of being able to engage with the indies. Sony goes as far as to give dev kits to you know, colleges and universities, commercial ones, and tells, you know, the kids there learning how to code that, hey, it's okay if you want to make a commercial game and stick it on the PS4. That's
cool.
Difficult to, yeah, it's really great. And it's difficult to manage on a global scale, but Sony really invests in it. Microsoft has kind of given up on the indies, and Nintendo doesn't really have that kind of depth of reach to do what it probably wants to do with indies. So, you know, Sony itself as a company went through all kinds of trouble as well. And I think it needed to redefine itself. And I think the PlayStation 4 is probably, you know, Sony's threw everything at it. And it worked, I think.